I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. I'm going to have Representative Chair Loon start us off. But before we do that, members in your packets, you do have the minutes.
Yeah, we do.
Members, I am going to ask that Representative Ward, you want to move the minutes for April 11th?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes from April 11th.
Representative Ward moves the minutes for April 11th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are adopted. Chair Loon, I'm going to move House File 3600, the... Okay. Can we send it back to K-12 Finance? Does that work for you?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So we're going to go to send it to House K-12 Finance, and with that, to your vote.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Under the Every Student Succeeds Act, states are required by federal law to publish online the per-pupil spending for each school and district in the state, and these expenditures have to be broken down by funding source, whether they be federal, state, or local. So meeting the requirements of this new federal law will depend partly on how we categorize and track the revenues and the expenditures at the school level, not just district. The Education Finance Committee has held hearings on how we look at these issues of transparency and specifically trying to drill down on these expenditures and whether or not that information is actually readily available and accessible to the public as well as policymakers. And so this bill is really kind of a result of an advocacy effort by a group of teachers, Educators for Excellence, and they came to me suggesting that the legislative auditor do a study of how the revenue that is generated by specific students, because a student, depending on perhaps categories they may fit in, then generate certain streams of revenue, and compare how that revenue is being spent and how it's being reported. I do have a DE amendment, Madam Chair.
Yes, and I'll move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the order the author wishes. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Chair Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so this amendment, I just wanted to comment that I did meet with the Office of Legislative Auditor about this proposed project, and they had some suggestions for how to kind of get their arms around this, because obviously with the number of school districts we have and the number of school sites within districts, if they had to do this for everyone, it would be an overwhelming task. And so we sort of made some clarifications, and they helped develop this amendment to basically limit it to a sampling of schools to try to collect this information. So I think that will be helpful in making this be sort of a manageable study but still get at the information we're seeking. And with that, I would turn it over to my testifier. Again, it was educators who brought this to me, and I think they're probably best poised to talk about the need for it.
Great. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Great. Madam Chair, members, my name is Madeline Edison. I am the Executive Director of Educators for Excellence Minnesota. We work with Representative Loon and other authors on this bill because of our approximately 2,000 teacher members who work predominantly in metro area schools, who select our policy focus for each year, and then they themselves, the teachers, generate policy recommendations, including the report that's in front of you today. They worked for approximately 3 months to conduct research, survey other teachers, and then generate recommendations on this topic, which was important to teachers because of especially in a few of our larger districts right now, undergoing budget issues and looking to make sure that our students who have the greatest needs are actually getting the dollars that they really need to be successful. And so when our members began researching this issue, and one of the first questions they asked is, of the money that we currently have available, where is it being spent? Is it being spent equitably? And to what end? And what became evident in our research process is that while we collect a lot of information about school finances, and there are many different reports available, there are currently not tremendously clear answers to some of the questions they raise, and there's a need for more financial transparency in our schools. A few things did become clear is that Minnesota has a very laudable progressive funding formula in which the state provides more funding per pupil for districts and schools that serve higher populations of special education students, English learners, and students living in poverty. And while the state formula includes several equitable spending provisions, because the funds are allocated to districts rather than to schools or students directly themselves, it's unclear how much of that funding allocated by you all at the legislature is then reaching the students who have those greater needs. And that's because of a few issues that could result in intra-district inequities or differences between schools in the same district. Things like staff-based budgeting rather than student-based allocation as a budgeting model, for example. Or staff-based budgeting that is based on average teacher salary in the district rather than the actual teacher salary in the building, which is important because we know that more experienced teachers more often work in well-off schools, and our schools with high poverty often has less experienced teachers. And so those budgeting differences really do impact what happens in the school building. And so as Representative Loon mentioned, the opportunity that we have in front of us is the state implements the Every Student Succeeds Act, which is the new version of No Child Left Behind. We will be required to report on these in a publicly accessible way that is transparent to teachers, families, and the average person. And because we're in a fortunate position that Minnesota collects a lot of this data, our reporting system is what needs to be worked on. So you need to be able to access different reports on the website where you're currently, when you go on the revenue side and then expenditure side, they're all different places, and you cannot easily compare across schools to be able to make a determination about what's going on in your school as a parent. So some folks will ask this question, we already know things are inequitable, or we already have this information, but it's not exactly true because we need to be able to easily compare revenues and expenditures per pupil at each school to determine if the funds are allocated by the state or reaching the students they are intended to serve. And this is hard to find and may contain inconsistencies in how schools report things like salaries and transportation costs to MDE. We need to be able to trace funding sources like compensatory revenue to the schools to see how they're being allocated, and that's currently not reported. And more than anything, we need easy and understandable reports. Right now, you have to be sort of a wizard in Excel to be able to compare the files to make good conclusions with the data. So an OLA audit can help uncover the issues that currently exist in how schools report to the Department of Education, determine differences across schools within the same district, and then my hope is that they will generate recommendations on clear reporting, and we can use the information that the auditor's office concludes to determine any changes necessary to how we allocate our budget. So it's an urgent question because of the Every Student Succeeds Act, and we're required to have this information by summer of 2019, so now is a really great time to undergo this task, and thank you for your consideration of this bill that I hope will lead to clear answers to the questions of if our students who have the greatest needs are actually getting the financial support that they deserve. So thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay. With that, I've got a Representative Quam, and then I just want to highlight this is going to be coming out of Chair Loon's budget for the study itself. So I just want to make sure that's clear to members. Representative
That's correct,
Quam.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Edson, you know, looking at the data and the things you touched upon, one of the things that's been evident over the years is, you know, funding per classroom. And then I've seen multiple calculations of, you know, class size because some used to use, we've got a total number of licensed teachers. However, in some of the districts, a large portion of licensed teachers are not in the classroom. And so is the idea out of this report that you can easily get the detail of, you know, what's the teacher staff and what portion of that licensed teacher staff actually teaches or is in a non-teaching role curriculum or one of the multitude of other more administrative ones, you know, the breakout of the cost, administrative costs, and then the non-licensed, non-administrative you know, support staff cost. But the funding per classroom, I think, would be key on sites, because I remember, you know, over the multiple terms I was on that committee, of people coming and saying, you know, we need an extra teacher, and I did the math, what they were quoting for class size times the amount that they were being funded. They had several hundred thousand dollars of funding in that classroom, and it seemed as if maybe it wasn't quite going, you know, the right way. And part of the reason I like what you're doing, but would like the data, is my resident district where I was on the school board is the lowest per pupil funded school district in the state of regular school district in the state of Minnesota, even though it had a Blue Ribbon High School, won the Intel Math Award. But they have a lot of pressure, and it, you know, how long can you maintain with that? I see the average funding for Minnesota. Boy, we'd like to have 60 or 80% of that, you know, so that every time you do money in, the gap between the school district and others, a lot of the school districts in southern Minnesota, increases between the average. And so out of this report, are you going to have semi-definition of here's the base funding to be able to educate the average student, to educate a student with this category of special needs, so that way we can see where the floor ought to be?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for your question. I think you're pointing out one of the examples of differences in how schools might calculate the licensed staff versus class size. And so one of the things that our members would like to see, and you can see on page 8 in the report, is the number of teachers as well as the total salary cost. So you can actually judge that for yourself. Now, when it comes to are they in the classroom versus out, I don't know if this that would be covered under this report, but my hope is that with the information around here's the total that's being spent on salaries, here's the total that's being spent on administrative costs, then parents, family members, teachers could then advocate if they see that, you know, our school is being allocated X amount of money and it's not actually reaching the students at the expenditure level, then we need to advocate for some change about how that works within our district. So I do hope that it could be a tool for whomever within a district to be able to advocate to make sure that their students get what they need.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I eagerly await the final details of this report. However, it doesn't sound as if it's going to give the details of the questions that I've asked over the years and haven't received answers to.
Any other questions, members? Representative Kunesh-Pudi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. In your report on page 4, you state that the state formula includes several inequitable spending provisions, and because the dollars are allocated to districts and not directly to schools or students, it is unclear how much of the money actually reaches the students for whom the dollars are intended. In this investigation or this report, did you find examples of how those funds were not actually getting to where they are intended to go? And if that's the case, would you share some of those with us?
Ms. Edison.
Madam Chair, Representative, one of the examples that we read about was an example out of Duluth Public Schools that made some news a few months ago, and I can't remember if it made it into the report or not, but it was an example of compensatory revenue being generated by students within Duluth Public Schools, and when they traced where the funding was actually going, a disproportionate amount of the funding was going to a higher income school within that same district to support the general education costs of students within that building, and that was uncovered by reporters, and so that was not a publicly available information. This was something that they had to FOIA to determine where the funding was going. So that was one example that we found, but we did find that there was not clear data in a lot of schools that we looked into around, for example, compensatory revenue, or I heard that Commissioner Casilius testified in front of a committee just this week and said that there's a reading program that's $10 million that she can't say if it's even going to the reading programs that's it's intended to benefit, because districts tend to, you know, use money however they have needs, especially when they have budget cuts. Something gets allocated to other needs like staffing. And so those were a couple of examples that we saw, but I would imagine that this audit would actually uncover some more examples of that.
And then another question I have for you, again on page 4, the statement, across the nation and in Minnesota, students of color and students living in poverty are more likely to be taught by inexperienced and ineffective teachers than their more affluent peers. How are you able to justify, well, I guess I would like you to define what ineffective teachers are. And then if you can justify that statement.
Madam Chair, Representative. So unlike in Minnesota, we do not actually collect teacher evaluation data at the state level, and we don't have plans to do that. But many other states have collected that data at a state level and can make determinations about how students living in poverty, EL students, special education students, are being assigned disproportionately to teachers that are inexperienced, ineffective, or underprepared in school settings. And so that is not something that we've seen happen or have clear data about our state, but we can likely make the same conclusion if our state is anything like other states in the country.
Representative Ganesh Puri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am a teacher. I'm an active teacher. I'm a library media specialist when I'm not here at the legislature. In all my career, I have worked in schools of high diversity and schools that generally do not have their needs met financially or resourcefully. Unless that is a statement that you can actually prove and show statistics that really make that a true statement, I would ask that you not include that in there, because I, for many reasons, and we won't go into it today, there are many reasons why the inexperienced teachers are in those schools through no fault of their own. When they come into the teaching profession at a lower salary, a lot of times they are and I know that happened with me. I got my first teaching job because I'm at a lower salary, and they were able to fill that spot. That doesn't make me inefficient at all. And I would just like to say that in my 20-some years of teaching, there are very, very, very few ineffective new teachers or ineffective teachers that I have come across. And more often than not, you know, we work hard as a team within our school to help those teachers, and that's a true statement. We work hard to make sure that they're getting the resources and the kind of support that they need. So that is a statement that I would ask you to remove from this report unless you can very much prove it, even though I know anecdotally that is a perception for many folks around the nation. But I do want to make sure that it's noted that Minnesota does have really good, strong teachers in some of these schools, you know, and I can go into my reasons why I think the schools are not getting the resources, or perhaps are shifting resources as needed, but I just wanted to make a statement on that effect. Thank you.
All right, Chair Loon, do you want to wrap it up for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee members. I appreciate your questions and comments on this. And just to really briefly address the concern raised by Representative Kunesh Pudin, I think, again, this is not to denigrate teachers or to say that, you know, we have a lot of ineffective teachers. But the fact is, right now, districts, when they're doing their reporting, they calculate an average teacher salary and report that across their buildings. And we do know, anecdotally, but we'd like to have the actual evidence, that in some of our schools of highest poverty and some of the lowest performing schools, just looking at standardized tests, and I know there's many ways to measure student performance, but we do know anecdotally a lot of them have the lesser experienced teachers, and some of our more experienced and teachers that we would know from their years of service to be highly effective are not necessarily being placed in those schools where perhaps those students could benefit most from their experience. So I think collecting the kind of data that we're seeking and that we're actually going to have to be reporting as part of the federal requirements will point us to some good data points that we can then decide if we want to act upon or not as a legislature. So I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Chair Loon. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3600, as amended, be referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. Appreciate your work on this. I can see this as a tool in helping to close the achievement gap, so I think that's great. With that, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The bill is on its way. Thank you, Chair Loon.
Thank you very much, Committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
I do have a handout here.
Representative Scott, I am going to move House File 2953 be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government finance bill. And I see that you have a DE3 amendment. Yep. Would you like me to move that?
Yes, please.
I'm going to move the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author wishes. All those in favor of the DE3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Chair Scott, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this bill would move the Data Practices Office to the Office of Administrative Hearings. By creating an Information Policy Analysis Unit within the Office of Administrative Hearings that will function similar to the Data Practices Office. I'll explain why this move makes sense. First, many people have difficulty getting their data requests to government entities fulfilled. In the Data Practices Commission, we hear about this frequently. Enforcement of the Minnesota Data Practices Act is an issue we have and are attempting to address. One reason enforcement is so difficult and for some impossible is that there's currently a $1,000 filing fee to bring an enforcement action at the Office of Administrative Hearings. Most people simply cannot afford this. Uncooperative government entities know this, and in order to weed out frivolous cases, I have lowered the filing fee, all but $50 of which is refundable if a plaintiff prevails, to $250. By lowering the filing fee, people will not be deterred from bringing an action if the government is violating the Data Practices Act. Unless you think that this will cause the OAH to be flooded with cases, keep in mind that current law clearly states that anyone determined to have brought a frivolous or baseless case will have to pay the other party's reasonable costs and attorney fees. Secondly, making this move makes organizational sense by having personnel that carry out the duties laid out in statute housed in one location. The Data Practices Office has $1 million biannual budget for 4 employees. They also charge for many of their educational workshops, which adds up to tens of thousands of dollars annually. The OAH is statutorily required to provide expedited hearings to a complainant seeking an order to compel a government entity to comply with the Data Practices Act. Even though they collect a $1,000 filing fee, often the cases brought before the OAH are complicated, and the $1,000 does not cover the cost for the hours spent by the OAH judges on each case. Annual shortfalls range from several hundred dollars to around $26,000 a year. The legislature has to make up the shortfall. By making this move, the OAH has said the funding will be sufficient to lower the filing fee that so often keeps our constituents from justice. This move will improve enforcement as uncooperative government entities will no longer be able to, in essence, hide behind the filing fee that was keeping them from having to comply. As far as the operations of the Data Practices Offices in recent years, there have been frustrations. The number of opinions they have issued has declined, and that's what the handout before you reflects. The latest data I have shows that in 2014 they issued 20 opinions, in 2015 they issued 7, 2016 they issued 6. In 2015, one of the opinion requests actually came from my office. I asked for an opinion to substantiate the authority under which Governor Dayton was allowed to view investigative data in a still active investigation, specifically the ambulance video data in the Jamar Clark shooting. The request for an opinion was denied. Clearly, there was no previous opinion similar to this request, but the commissioner's duty to write opinions is permissive in current law. This bill changes that. The rationale that IPAD has provided for this is that fewer opinions need to be issued since many of the matters brought to IPAD for opinions are similar to past opinions. However, in the past, IPAD would issue opinions on almost all matters as a way to provide enforcement, since the requester was given validation that an agency was not acting correctly. Also, if IPAD does not feel the need to issue as many advisory opinions, why are we not seeing a corresponding decrease in the appropriation? By moving to OAH, it takes the pressure off of appointed commissioners having to issue advisory opinions on the governor who appointed them. It's important that the complicated area of data practices law is not swept up in politics. Judges are held to a different ethical standard, which is why moving the data practices office functions to a quasi-judicial body makes sense. So to recap, making this move makes sense. It will provide citizens a path for enforcement and cause government entities to be more responsive and transparent. It will create efficiencies by having a one-stop shop for Minnesotans. It will stop the cost overruns currently being experienced at the OAH for data practices hearings. And it moves advice and opinions on Chapter 13 and 13D from an agency to a quasi-judicial body, which is who should be interpreting the law. And that is the end of my testimony, Madam Chair, and I'm glad to take questions, or I know there is a list of testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Scott. We're going to go to testifiers, members. I've got Commissioner Mossman, Mark Antonson. If you can kind of get in queue, if you would. So after the commissioner, we have Mark Antonson, then Irene Kyle. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Commissioner Mossman, Minnesota Department of Administration. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some comments on House File 2953, a bill that, as Chair Scott says, proposes to move the State Data Practices Office from the Department of Administration to the Office of Administrative Hearings. I applaud Chair Scott's consideration of the proper alignment of data practices within state government. Such periodic assessment of how government is organized can be valuable to promoting innovation and efficiency. Ultimately, it is up to the legislature, I think, to determine whether this approach would be better for Minnesotans. I believe the proposal reflects a drastic response relative to the concerns put forth, is unwarranted, and would put at risk a system that, by all objective measures, has worked very well for Minnesotans. And I'll focus my comments on that central question here. Government transparency is essential to free, fair, and well-functioning democracy. Chapter 13 and Chapter 13D lay out robust, albeit sometimes complicated and siloed, requirements for government transparency and open meetings, while also balancing that transparency with the reasonable expectations for individual safety and privacy. Chapter 13 applies to the state executive and judicial branches and legislative auditor, and Chapter 13D applies to all public bodies in Minnesota. Neither law applies to the legislature. Admin's Data Practices Office provides guidance to the public and government entities on Chapters 13 and 13D. It drafts advisory opinions and advises on temporary classification requests for data and data challenge appeals. And it has provided this functionality since the inception of Chapter 13 in the 1970s. We take our responsibility to oversee Chapter 13 very seriously. And I believe that maintaining the Data Practices Office at the Department of Administration is in the best interest of taxpayers. I encourage legislators to closely evaluate whether or not and why House File 2953 would be a preferred approach, or if there is perhaps a less extreme measures that should be first considered to address the concerns being raised. I am respectfully aware of Chair Scott's frustration with admin's decision to decline to provide an advisory opinion in response to her request in 2015. However, that decision was the correct decision under the law, and this bill would not change that outcome. The classified nonpartisan staff at the Department of Administration who lead data practices have a well-deserved positive reputation for providing timely, thoughtful, and objective advice. I have the utmost confidence in these staff, and I believe that many of you have also had positive experiences with those staff over time. The regular customer feedback collected by the data practices office is overwhelmingly positive. About a year ago, a Metro newspaper reported on a decline in the number of formal advisory opinions issued by the state. That trend has also been raised by Chair Scott, and you have the handout that she provided, the graph. But that trend began well before this administration, as you can see from the graph, and it reflects a natural maturation of the data practices program. Other than the one press article in this legislation, the department has received little, if any, negative feedback on the services provided for one simple reason. Most stakeholders like what we do, and they may not always like the answers they get, but we handle our work professionally, objectively, and expediently toward getting Minnesotans access to the government data that they are entitled to as quickly as possible and doing so at no charge to them. Let me provide some more specifics. Advisory opinions are, and always have been, only a small portion of the work performed by the State Data Practices Office to promote compliance with Chapter 13 and 13D. Training and access to immediate, informal, expert advice is extremely valuable work. In fact, of our over 3,000 contacts with customers, the majority are for training and informal assistance. And we get far more requests for training than we are able to respond to with the resources we have. I would also point out that the advisory opinions serve as opinions not only for the specific requesters, but are intentionally written such that they provide guidance to promote compliance in all similar situations. We maintain a searchable library of all previous advisory opinions on our website. This opinion library is readily available as a self-help resource, as well as a pathway to allowing us to expeditiously resolve questions and or disputes quickly to achieve what is the primary goal of Chapter 13, to ensure timely, transparent access to government data as provided for in law. Given that advisory opinions remain precedential over time and that most of our customers prefer the most expedient solution to gain access to government data, it should be expected that the number of formal advisory opinions might decline over time, as they have. Let me be clear. We always issue a formal opinion when unaddressed issues arise, a safe harbor is warranted, or we believe a governmental entity has it wrong, or maybe being obstinate. Ironically, I believe House File 2953 attempts to codify the very expectation with the new Information Policy Analysis Unit to perform precisely the same techniques of informal advisory opinions and training that the Admin Data Practices Office is being criticized for performing as a way to access government data as opposed to always issuing advisory opinions. Additionally, the bill would, for the first time ever, open the door to politicizing oversight of Chapter 13 by creating an unclassified position to direct the office. And it seems likely that House File 2953 would actually lead to diminished service levels over time by requiring that advisory opinions be issued in all cases. I would note, just from the testimony of Chair Scott, that in particular, I think the fee change ideas that she expressed with regard to the Office of Administrative Hearings, I actually think are a good idea, and I would point out that those fee change recommendations could be made and would probably be advisable to provide easier access for complicated cases to the Office of Administrative Hearings process and that could be done without moving the office to the Office of Administrative Hearings. In summary, it seems the bill is an excessive response. I and my team are more than willing to listen to and act on feedback from stakeholders. I believe this bill would have a negative effect on government transparency. I, and again, encourage legislators to closely consider what the goal and impact of this bill would be if enacted. Thank you, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. At this point, I'm just going to go through the testifiers, but I do have questions for you. So if you can just stick around as we work through the testifier list, and then I'll bring you back, okay?
I'm happy to stick around, Madam Chair. I do have a commitment. If I'm not here, my staff will be here the whole time.
Perfect. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Anthonson. And then after that, I have Ms. Cow, Ryan Zip, and Mr. Carlson. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Anthonson. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mark Anthonson. I am the general counsel for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, the trade association of all the state's newspapers. Normally, when Representative Scott carries a bill before a committee here, I come up to the table and testify in strong support of the bill. She has been a champion of public access the whole time she's been in the legislature, and we have often tried to express our appreciation for her work in that respect. And I think citizens across the state, as well as the news media, have benefited from much of what Representative Scott has done on this topic over the years. However, could I stop there?
I wanted to catch you before you said that.
So with that said, and I do want to acknowledge that publicly, I also want to emphasize that I speak against this bill today, and I do so reluctantly because of what I just said. I also want to point out that our dispute on the bill is not about the goals. Representative Scott is attempting to do something that's good, reform and improve the operation of an important government office. We are, however, deeply concerned about the methods that are being proposed to get to that goal, to achieve those goals. And I say this with some experience. I have probably worked with the Data Practice Office more than any other human being in the state, not a particular distinction, but it's just a fact. I also can tell you that the OAH process that would absorb the DPO under this bill was something that the Newspaper Association originally brought to the legislature in 2010. It was a bill that we had crafted and participated in drafting because we thought it was a good idea to have a process that was cheaper than the district courts for resolving serious disputes. And it is a good process. Here are, though, our two core concerns with this particular bill. Number one, the Office of Administrative Hearings is a judicial office. If you go to its website, the first thing you see on its homepage is we are a judicial agency. The office that deals with data practices issues in the Department of Administration is not that at all. The great way that office has functioned over the years is based on the fact it can resolve disputes about the Data Practices Act informally. And it's important to understand in this context how complex the Data Practices Act has become and how often there is disagreement and uncertainty among citizens and government employees about what the law requires. And so you really benefit at all levels of government if you have a fairly simple and formal process that can be used to resolve these questions. Our fear is that by transferring this agency, this office, the Data Practice Office, to a judicial agency, you're going to end up over time skewing the function of the office. It's going to become more formalized. It's going to become more judicial. It's going to be more difficult to resolve things informally. And that would be a real loss in terms of what we have now. The second concern that I would note for you is that I think there's a serious conflict of interest issue here in terms of how the Data Practice Office would function within OAH, because the Data Practice Office offers, as we talked about, informal decisions about data practices issues. If an OAH judge is then subsequently asked to rule on one of the office's informal opinions, does that Does that look good? Does that make sense? Is that an appropriate way to deal with these kinds of issues? We don't think so. And, again, we think over time everything would become more contested. So, final point. What we are looking at here is really sort of net benefits versus net disadvantages, the upside-downside equation. And in our view, the uncertainty of what might happen, and it's a pretty significant uncertainty. The uncertainty of what might happen by moving this office to OAH versus the unquestionable benefits this office has provided to Minnesota residents in the news media for 20 or more years, and they really are quite impressive. That risk of dismantling or disrupting that function cannot be outweighed by the benefits that the bill might provide. So, Madam Chair, with that, I will stop. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Anthonson. If you can stick around, we might have questions for you later on.
I will. Okay? Thank you.
Ms. Kao and then Mr. Zip. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Irene Gao, and I am with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm going to leave the substance of the testimony to Mr. Zift in just a minute, but I did want to, similarly as Mr. Anfitson had started, thank Representative Scott. She has worked with us to attempt to address some of our concerns, but unfortunately we are in a place where we still do have concerns. But I will stick around, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cow. Mr. Zift, and hopefully I'm saying your name right.
Zift. He's silent, so pretty close.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the panel, Representative Scott, my name is Ryan Zift. I'm a litigation supervisor at the League of Minnesota Cities. I supervise a group of attorneys and paralegals who represent municipalities in lawsuits, many of them involving data practices claims. As Ms. Gao stated, we really appreciate Representative Scott working with us and addressing some of the concerns that we have with this bill. However, we still have three specific concerns that I'd like to raise with the committee here. First is the concern of the potential for increased litigation costs for municipalities and taxpayers. Proposed House File 2953 significantly lowers the filing fees to litigate data practices issues at the Office of Administrative Hearings. In 2010, an agreement was reached addressing the handling of disputes on data practices. As part of that agreement with the newspapers and the House of Administrative Hearings, a $1,000 filing fee was agreed to in order to have cases on data practices issues heard before the Office of Administrative Hearings. The amount was set at $1,000 to balance a litigant's access, make sure they have access to OAH, while at the same time making sure that OAH would not get overwhelmed with data practice litigation. This bill undermines that agreement in that proposing the change of the filing fee down to $250, we're unsure if this is enough to kind of continue that balance of ensuring that there's access to OAH if you want to litigate a data practices issues, while at the same time avoiding that OAH is not overwhelmed with data practices litigation. The second concern we want to specifically raise is that the current informal resolution and advisory opinion process already enhances compliance without increasing litigation costs for municipalities and taxpayers. Currently, the informal consultation with the Data Practices Office significantly enhances compliance. And as Mr. Anfitson has already indicated, analyzing data practices and open meeting law issues are inherently complex and complicated issues to analyze. The Data Practices Office has a staff of experienced professionals who have a lot of experience handling these types of issues and analyzing these types of issues. But this amendment would not transfer that Data Practices Office staff to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And one concern that we have is the loss of this institutional experience and knowledge if these amendments were adopted. The final concern, again, to echo what Mr. Anfitson already discussed, is a potential conflict of interest if the Data Practices Office falls under the Office of Administrative Hearing, which ultimately determines litigated cases. Now, the League of Minnesota Cities does not have a position on where the Data Practices Office should be located at within an agency, but we do have specific concerns moving it to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Chief Administrative Law Judge would supervise the Data Practices Coordinator, And the concern would be whether the data practices coordinator's legal analysis would be compromised if the coordinator has a different opinion or a conflicting opinion as to what the administrative law judge has on how a data practices issue should be handled. To avoid a potential conflict of interest, we would suggest it's better to separate the data practices office and another agency from the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is ultimately the body that decides litigated cases. Finally, if there are any concerns with the data practices office as it currently operates right now, we propose that there are more narrow ways to address these concerns. Thank you for your testimony. And legal will continue to work with Representative Scott and appreciate her assistance in helping to make some changes to this bill. I'm available to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Carlson and then Ms. Kleinfield. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Today I'm speaking on behalf of our organization and the Association of Minnesota Counties. And much of the concerns that have been raised by Mr. Anfinson and the League of Minnesota Cities are shared by us. The primary one is the inherent conflict of interest that exists within this bill. As has been identified by the previous testifiers, the Office of Administrative Hearings is a semi-judicial agency. By giving them the duties that are now performed by the Department of Administration and in issuing advisory opinions and then keeping within that agency the appeal process that currently exists under law, you're essentially doing the equivalent of providing that the district courts would adopt the laws, criminal laws and civil laws that they administer, and then they would rule on those laws' application, such as just not appropriate whatsoever. I do appreciate that Representative Scott met with representatives of local government as well as the Newspapers Association and has made some changes with this bill to address some of our concerns, but that conflict of interest is our largest one. I do want to continue that we also have concern with the transfer to the OAH of the change of the employee status of the supervisor of what is now the IPAD division from a classified to an unclassified position. That will politicize the potential opinions that are issued by the agency, and we think that is unfortunate. Again, I will say, as many others, we don't always like the opinions that come out of the agency, but we do appreciate the body of law that they've effectively created and the fairness with which it's administered. A similar concern that we have with the transfer to the OAH is whether or not there will be a commitment to this process. Those of you who have been around for a while, I know that the budget setting process does not really start with you, nor does it start with the governor or the Department of Management and Budget. It starts with the agency that submits its proposed budget to the Commissioner of Management and Budget, who subsequently brings it to the governor, who makes his or her recommendations. The Department of Administration has shown a commitment to this function that, frankly, we're concerned will not exist with the Office of Administrative Hearings. Its primary function is to be a judicial agency that administers judicial law. An important function has again been addressed multiple times by the previous testifiers, is the training provided by this agency. Local governments in particular have encouraged you in the past to increase the funding for the training function of this agency, and the Department of Administration does a good job with the funds that are available to it, but they can only do so much. For those of you who don't realize it, to basically stretch those dollars, many of the statewide governmental organizations actually pay for the agency to come out and provide training to kind of stretch those dollars. Again, without the commitment to that training that we feel may possibly be lacking. if this is transferred to OAH, we have concerns. Final issue I want to address is the Philando Castile issue. If that is the issue, the concern that an opinion was not addressed by the agency, it's simply a matter of amending Section 13072. The other changes that are made in this with the reduction in the filing fee, we share the concerns of the League of Minnesota Cities. We thought we reached an agreement with the proponents at the filing level that this would be for serious issues that need to be litigated, and consequently are concerned about the cost, because we end up paying attorney's fees and the cost of the hearings. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions as you get through the remainder of the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Kleinfeld has declined to testify, or I don't know if she's not here or what, but is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Okay. Members, I have a couple questions, and then I'll see if anybody else has questions. Chair Scott, I'm looking at your DE3 amendment, and I'm looking at Section 7 on page 7. And to me, this looks like this is addressing the whole issue of the conflict of interest. Of the testifiers that came up, they expressed concern about that. And here it looks like what you're trying to do is to address that concern on the conflict of interest. Can you kind of, am I accurate in reading through that? Or?
Madam Chair, yes, you're correct. Not only is it on page 7, but also on page 2. At 2.8, you'll see some language there that also addresses the screening process so that the administrative law judges and the people doing the informal advising of the public and of other government entities, they're screened from one another.
Okay. And well, and since we're on page 2, Chair Scott, I'm looking at page 2, line 4, so that some of the concern was that this would make it too judicial, too court-like. Does that line get at that issue? Is that the intent of the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. Yes, that gets at part of it, but if you notice, the whole first section of the bill really talks about transferring all of the duties and responsibilities that are currently housed at the Data Practices Office over to this new, the Information Policy Analysis Unit, and the person that would be kind of in charge, or the face person there, would be a data practices coordinator. So we're setting up a structure very similar to what is currently at the Data Practices Office. The functions will be the same. Some of the big differences will be that if you ask for an advisory opinion, you're going to get one. And it's not, in referring to that, Madam Chair, I gave the example of the Jamar Clark, the governor's viewing of that video. I have at least four other, and I didn't make copies, of this, but four other requests for opinions from, these are just from legislators, where opinions were denied. And I believe, as someone that swims in this water of data practices, wrongfully denied opinions. And so it's not just one thing. That or one denial that was the reason for making this change. It was a host of things, including just making an efficient process for the public, having everything housed under one location.
And Chair Scott, when you say that those were denials, meaning that they didn't offer any opinion at all, is that?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Members, any other questions at all? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, and it probably be to Mr. Zip. If Madam Chairman,
Representative Vogel,
on this conflict of interest, are you saying that there could be then very little, if any, conflict of interest when this is already housed in the executive branch?
Mr. Zip.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think the concern is that when you have, in essence, the administrative chief administrative law judge and the judges under that person's supervision issuing decisions, and then you have, in essence, kind of the data practices coordinator responsible for writing informal opinions. I think the challenge is, and again, it's going to be when you're reporting directly kind of through a chain of command to that chief administrative law judge, I think it becomes challenging if, let's say, you have an opinion that's going to differ or, let's say, inconsistent with what other opinions have been written by the administrative office administrative hearing judge. I think that's going to be challenging for them to, in essence, write an opinion that may refute what the ALJ may have previously written or what another administrative law judge has written. Based on other experiences that I've had, you know, both through the military and through civil practice, typically when it's probably a little bit, you can kind of immunize people a little bit if you have them reporting to separate organizations. So for example, like the data practices office reporting to another supervisor who's able to render those opinions, and that way they're not kind of wrapped up with, they're not kind of falling under the person who then, in a judicial way, is hearing these cases, litigating these cases, and issuing decisions. Basically, you keep them separate, and you get, I think, probably a little more independent opinions out of the data practices office.
Representative. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, isn't Department of Administration in the executive branch?
That's correct,
Representative.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, so here we had a case that brought this to light where we had somebody in the executive branch that was relying on an opinion that had this work in their favor. So I guess my point is that I believe there's a conflict of interest that could occur in many cases, and indeed maybe this case that we're talking about right now that brought this to light did. So that's my point is, do you think that there couldn't have been any conflict of interest there in as much as the executive branch is headed by the governor who appoints the person that ultimately comes down in the org chart to the person that was making this opinion?
Mr.
Ziff? Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. I don't know the exact circumstances of why there was a denial, specifically the Jamar Clark circumstance. From my understanding, it had to do with more about, you know, where did the data practice office have authority to issue opinions to? I think that was more the issue. I think those are things that I believe it's suggested by the county's representative that there are other ways to remedy that issue that aren't necessarily to remedy that issue rather than going through kind of these wholesale changes that are being proposed.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, so I'm not accusing of a conflict of interest here. But what you're pointing out is that we shouldn't do the change because of a conflict of interest, and I'm suggesting that that same conflict of interest could exist in the case now, so they may negate each other. Would that be at all an accurate statement?
Again, what I would suggest is it's probably better to separate out the person who's at the data practices office giving their own opinion from basically the Office of Administrative Hearing, where that issue will be litigated and decided separately. Again, I think it'd be very hard if you're under, in essence, where the Office of Administrative Hearings is at, to issue an opinion that's adverse to what has been previous decisions of that particular chief administrative law judge or any other administrative law judges in that office. I think it creates an appearance of a conflict, but also it simply puts them in kind of an untenable position of having to write opinions directly against what might be their supervisors.
Representative,
I have no more questions.
Well, to that end, Mr. Ziff, what happens if you are you had made a request for information from the Department of Administration and then you had to go back to the Department of Administration for an advisory opinion? Do you see that there would be a conflict of interest there where you would have staff that are employed by the Department of Administration giving an opinion on a request for information to their boss?
I apologize. I wasn't quite tracking that one. What I'm typically experiencing, Madam Chair.
I'll clarify it for you.
Yeah.
So Department Administration, Commissioner Administration, is in charge of this division within his agency, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so when you have an individual private citizen that would request information related to the Department of Administration, and then the Department of Administration division that is responsible for giving those advisory opinions, they would, in effect, be giving an advisory opinion that may be contrary to what their supervisor, their boss, the commissioner, would like. So wouldn't that be a conflict of interest?
Well, again, I think that might be better addressed to the Department of Administration of how their processes work. My understanding is that, and again, I don't work at the Department of Administration. I don't know how the processes work. My understanding is that the Data Practices Office, a lot of the staffers there, they're the ones who are primarily drafting those opinions, creating those opinions, and then under the advice and consultation of the Department of Administration, then they issue the decision. I can't talk about how within the Department of Administration works. I just know from my experience in litigation, in involving where I'm litigating with the judicial branch, I think putting someone under, in essence, the supervision of a judge in which they might be issuing opinions that are conflict with previous opinions those judges have made before, I think that's somewhat of an untenable position to put someone in basically this advisory role under a judicial supervisor.
But, Mr. Zip, you do realize that the commissioner of administration is the one that actually signs off on these?
Yes.
So if I have a private citizen that is making a request, an advisory opinion on a request that was denied by the commissioner of administration, you can see how that would be a conflict of interest, correct?
I apologize. I'm not tracking that again.
Okay. Well, we'll
maybe I'm a little slow today.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your time. I do have some questions for the Department of Administration. I know that the commissioner had to leave. So thank you, Mr. Ziff. Welcome. So I had some questions regarding this whole process. This is I appreciate the work that Chair Scott has put into this. So given the numbers in the chart that I'm looking at, you know, the high water mark was, I believe, in the Ventura era of 96 and 78. It looked, well, 78 and plenty administration. And now it's tapered down, so 6 or 7 in the last 2 years. Can you tell me, from a financial perspective, has the FTEs that are part of this division, have they decreased? What a level of funding is spent on this division through the Department of Administration?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Lori Barkpensky, Acting Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Administration. We had a handout that we weren't able to distribute that describes in more detail what the work of the four FTEs is. The vast majority of our work is spent on technical assistance and training. You can see the amount of time that is devoted to advisory opinions is minimized because we are able to informally resolve many of the conflicts that citizens call us about.
And Ms. Beyer-Krupinski, have you changed, though, the financial part? Can you give me, you know what, I'm just going to ask you to provide that to me offline. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see what the historical FTEs have been for this office, what the historical funding has been for this office. With that, members, any other questions? If not, Chair Scott, I just want to say I appreciate your work on this. I know you've been trying to address all the issues and concerns for those that are involved in this. Obviously, they respect you a great deal when it comes to this issue. And I just have to say, to me, this makes the most sense. You start it where it's going to end if there is a conflict that can't be resolved through an advisory opinion process. So to me, it makes a lot of sense. Appreciate your work on this. Final words for us at all.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want members to think for a minute if there was currently no Office of Data Practices right now and we wanted to create somewhere where the public could go and get help with their questions on the Data Practices Act, and where would be the best place to house that? Would it be in a department that oversees rental of state properties, the selling of state assets such as vehicles, those sort of administrative responsibilities, or would it be to house it in a place where they're finally, as you pointed out, Madam Chair, if they don't get the help that they need, that they're going to ultimately end up anyway. And I believe in the long run that the citizens of this state are going to be better served, because I think getting a call from someone that might be associated with, that is associated with a quasi-judicial branch is going to make the backbone of the Data Practices Act even stronger. And I think we're going to see more compliance and fewer cases going before the Office of Administrative Hearings for final disposition, because I think these matters are going to be solved even more frequently outside of that hearing room. So I would appreciate members' support.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2953, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Representative Vogel. Representative Vogel moves House File 3376, be laid over for possible inclusion in the State Government Finance Bill. Representative Vogel, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. House File 3376 basically puts in place parameters for professional relationships and process when the office, the state auditor's office, is doing assessments of county audits, or it could be done for other reasons as well. The reason that I had a concern and drafted this bill was as a result of the OLA audit that I think everybody is familiar with that we looked at not too long ago. There was concerns raised relative to the professional standards that were applied during that assessment. And from what I looked at, I didn't see that the accounting professional courtesies were extended. And I use that word professional courtesies because the accounting world is a different place, where because of the output that they have and the impact that they can have on different entities and indeed very large entities, there's a professionalism that has to be adhered to there. So that when that information, when the information goes out, the information can't be retracted. So that's what I mean by the professional courtesies here. It's not a handshake type thing. It's the way that the industry conducts itself. And in this case, I didn't feel that was done as properly as it should, especially relative to the OLA audit. And part of the problem was that there wasn't a review process, as is normal in the case, relative to the person or the entity being looked at. And what that has the potential to do is to lead to both a reputational risk and a professional standing risk, because the accounting firms themselves are judged both on, and I'm sure the testifier can tell you more on this if you're interested, but they're basically peer-reviewed and they're looked at professionally. So what this bill does is not change the ability of the Office of the State Auditor to conduct the assessments. What it says that is if you're going to conduct the assessments, you have to conduct them with the same professional standards and courtesy as would be the case if you were conducting an audit. And back in this report, the one line that grabbed my attention in the response, page 2 of the state auditor's response, was that the purpose of the OSA's special review is not an audit and did not give an opinion, so applying the GAAS would not be appropriate and would not clearly be considered best practice. And what this does is basically says, if you're going to do an assessment in the accounting world and put out public information, you're going to follow the same professional standards as you would in the audit process itself. So with that, Madam Chair, my introduction, and I know we have a testifier that probably can give a better understanding of what's going on than I can. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fragnito, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Gino Fragnito, the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota Society of Certified Public Accountants, and thank you for hearing House File 3376 today. As Representative Vogel indicated, House File 3376 is a result of findings released in a recent report by the Office of the Legislative Auditor and was heard earlier this year in this committee. And the two main findings in this report were that the Office of the State Auditor did not thoroughly support its findings of the CPA firms, nor did the Office of the State Auditor treat the CPA firms it reviewed with standard due process and professional courtesy that's normally practiced in the audit industry. The CPA firms were not afforded due process nor the opportunity to provide clarity or additional documentation when questions arose or it was believed that something was not fully documented. And while it was no secret that the state auditor was unhappy with the 2015 legislative change allowing counties the option to choose a CPA firm to conduct their own audit, it's also unfortunate that these firms, their employees, and their clients were subjected to a report that seemed to have a predetermined outcome before the process started. The decision to publish this report before allowing adequate opportunity for the firms to respond without a due process to address differences of professional judgment or the consideration of supporting data provided by the CPA firms damaged the firms, provided no recourse, and calls into question the objectivity and accuracy of this report. These firms are facing national reputational damage and additional expense because of this report. These and other firms are also questioning whether it's really worth it to do this type of work in the state of Minnesota. House File 3376 will provide guidelines and a clear process for CPA firms conducting county audits and hopefully eliminate any surprises from future reviews. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to Mr. Fragnito. I mean, it's a relatively simple bill here and everything else. Two questions. Do you feel that this increases the communication between these CPA firms and the state auditor to be able to resolve these types of conflicts amicably in the future? And do you also feel it increases the transparency of the process?
Mr. Fragnito.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do believe that it will increase the transparency, and the intent and the hope is that it will also increase the communication. The CPA firms were willing to have that dialogue. They just were not afforded the opportunity.
Correct.
Representative Lugo?
That's it, ma'am.
Any other questions? If not, Representative Vogel, final word?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. In my world of nerdity, And the reason I say that is because there are words in accounting such as opinion and materiality that matter. And what that leads to is subjectivity. And the reason that I'm so big on this is because of that, the way the process goes is to have a back-and-forth exchange before the reports are made. Mm-hmm. What was lacking here is that back-and-forth. And the report got out, and the reputational risk is now at there. And there wasn't a way to get that thing into a good form, because what we want is good information. And that's what this bill is about, and I appreciate you hearing it and the testimony, and that's it.
Great. Representative Vogel renews his motion that House File 3376 be laid over for possible inclusion in the state government finance bill. Thank you both. Representative Moran. Representative Moran, I'm going to move House File 3664 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair and members, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to present before the body. I especially want to give a huge thank you for Representative Pugh, who was able to present this bill in another committee in my absence. So thank you so much. So I have here with me Lily Anderson, who is a braider, entrepreneur, and a successful plaintiff in the 2005 lawsuit against the Minnesota Board of Cosmetology, who also testified, and Megan Forbes of the Institute for Justice, who will answer questions for us. So I'd like to give you a little background on the bill. So the bill repeals Minnesota 30-hour specialty license for hair braiders that was enacted in 2007. House File 3664, it is a technical bill, and it codifies in state law the consent judgment in Lillian Anderson's case that the Institute for Justice litigation that was litigated successfully. Hennepin County Judge Isabel Gomez issued a judgment that enjoined the board from enforcing any licensing requirements on braiders. So lawyers for the cosmetology board interpret the injunction as stopping the board from enforcing licensing requirements on braiders. And for that reason, the cosmetology board does not oppose this bill, and they will remain neutral on the position of the bill. So a little bit about the braiding. You know, braiding is like really simple. It is really what we do. It's culturally what we do as African Americans. It's very natural, and it has been handed down from generation to generation to generation. So hair, you know, we do different things with our hair, from braids to cornrows to locking, sewing, twisting. It's a combination of what we do. It is just really very, very natural. And there's absolutely no chemicals involved in a braiding process. So Minnesota law says that hair braiding does not involve the use of penetrating chemical hair treatments, chemical hair coloring agents, chemical hair straightening agents, chemical hair joining agents, permanent wave styles, or chemical hair bleaching agents applied to growing human hair. And I just want to state that this is not something that we're just doing here in Minnesota. There has been 23 other states that has completely exempted braiders from licensure. And we have additional legislators in six states who are also considering currently bills similar to House File 3664. So I'm going to stop there because I think more importantly, we have someone here who has been actively doing braiding, which a lot of us do, to testify on this bill, on behalf of this bill.
Ms. Lillian, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Lillian Anderson, and thank you for the committee and members of, thanks for Mrs. Chairman and members of committee. Thanks for the opportunity in order for me to testify on the favor of this bill, HF 366. I am an entrepreneur and a braider, and I was the plaintiff in the lawsuit against Anderson versus Cosmetology Board. I support this bill for two reasons only. First, braiding is a natural thing. Secondly, every braider should have the freedom to live the American dream and the right to earn an honest living. So please, I will, Senate members, I will appreciate if you guys can, the House can support this bill, HF 366. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. And we have another testifier.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3664. My name is Megan Forbes. I'm an attorney at the Institute for Justice. We're a national nonprofit public interest law firm that works to end unnecessary occupational licensing laws. We litigated Lillian's case in 2005, and we've been active in advocating for braider freedom across the country for more than 20 years. We support this bill because it eliminates an unnecessary barrier to earning an honest living in the state of Minnesota. I'm happy to answer any questions that you, Madam Chair, the members may have about the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Members, questions? If not, I am going to renew my motion that House File 3664 be laid over for possible inclusion. Oh, I forgot. Representative Moran, any final comment? I have no time. I was just like, let's go.
I think you're good, and I appreciate it.
All right, good. I'm going to renew my motion then that House File 3664 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. Thank you, Representative Moran. Thank you, Ms. Lillian Anderson and Ms. Forbes.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Representative Flanagan. And Representative Flanagan is going to move House File 3850 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. Representative Flanagan, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this bill exempts licensed eyelash technicians from the Cosmetology Board's facilities licensing requirements. Just a little background. In 2016, the legislature created a license for eyelash technicians. The license requires eyelash technicians complete 38 hours of training, pay licensing fees, and comply with infection control standards. They're also required to work in licensed salons. In addition, state law gives the Cosmetology Board the power to establish the conditions and process for getting an eyelash salon license. Unfortunately, the board has chosen a one-size-fits-all approach to salon licensing. I believe it has overzealously applied the same requirements for a full-service salon to eyelash technicians who are only providing one service. Many eyelash technicians cannot afford to comply with these requirements. They face astronomical costs trying to get their businesses into compliance with the board's requirements. They often lack resources that larger salons have to comply with these requirements. These additional requirements are not needed to protect consumers. As licensees, eyelash technicians are already required to comply with infection control standards, such as sanitizing their hands and cleaning their tools and equipment. Dissatisfied consumers can also file complaints with the board, and the board can fine eyelash technicians or revoke their license completely. The board's overzealous approach is keeping eyelash technicians, many of whom are women and women of color, from starting and having their own businesses. This bill would eliminate this unnecessary regulatory barrier and create opportunities for eyelash technicians across the state. Some of you may be surprised that I am bringing this bill forward, but I'm doing this through really through the lens of a bill that I believe is rooted in equity and ensuring, again, that women and women of color, that we are removing barriers to their participation as business owners and entrepreneurs. And to that point, I have a couple of folks who are with me additionally to testify in favor of the bill.
Great. Welcome to the committee. Who would like to go first? Ms. Forbes?
Good afternoon again, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3850. My name is Megan Forbes from the Institute for Justice. We support this bill because it exempts licensed eyelash technicians from burdensome and unnecessary facility licensing requirements. This bill does not change the 38-hour license, but it eliminates unnecessary regulatory hoops that eyelash technicians are having to jump through right now in the state. Eyelash technicians are having to spend thousands of dollars to satisfy the board's facility requirements. They've had to install extra sinks, move walls to meet certain square footage requirements, and even break current leases in order to try to meet these requirements when their current landlords won't allow them to do it. The board's facility requirements are excessive in relation to the limited and already licensed service that these technicians are providing. They already have to comply with strict infection control standards. The board can revoke the license if a consumer complains and is harmed, And if they have a commercial space, they also have to comply with local building codes, which require a sink and a bathroom. These laws already address public health and safety risks. In conclusion, we ask that you support House File 3850 because we believe it will help create opportunities for eyelash entrepreneurs across the state. Thank you.
Thank you. And is it Ms. Guajardo? Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today on behalf of favor for the House File 3850. My name is Brenda Tots. I have been an eyelash technician for 12 years now, and I own a salon in Alexandria. I am in support of this bill for three reasons. First, I have an established and thriving business that specializes in the application of eyelash extensions at my current facility for 8 years. My daughter and my daughter-in-law are also independent business owners with me. I have built this business solely through word of mouth, quality service, and strong work ethics. Each of us currently has a large client base. The second reason I support this bill is the requirements from the Board of Cosmetology for a salon license are expensive and burdensome. Because of the definition of a workspace, I am being required to install sinks in each of the rooms that have walls that go to the ceiling and a door that closes or is less than 5 feet wide. In my facility, there are 6 rooms. So one of them is not feasible for this, but that would be a total of 5 hand-washing sinks with counters. There is a bathroom with a sink in the building. The other option is to tear out the doorways to make them 5 feet wide, which will take away the privacy of my clients, and they value that. The level of safety and care that we give to our clients has been working fine with the one bathroom sink that we have. When talking about all these changes with our clients, they think it is unreasonable. The third and final issue with the facility license, I am being asked to make these expensive changes to a building that I don't own. So the owner does not want to tear out the doorways and widen them. And he said the sinks, he may allow me to do that, but at the end of the lease, if it's not renewed, I would have to remove them at my expense. So these renovations are going to cost close to $15,000. And honestly, I'm just trying to find the logic in having to install 5 sinks in a building that is less than 1,000 square feet. If the owner does not allow the changes, then I am expected to break my lease. And the final reason is at the end of my lease, which is approximately 2 years, I feel I'm reaching at a time in my life where I want to cut back and I want to be saving, not spending. And so to have to spend this chunk of money as I'm nearing the end of my career is going to add debt and be burdensome. So thank you for your time and hearing my story. Happy to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you, Ms. Tots. I'm going to go through the list of testifiers.
There's
and
one
then,
more testifier, Madam Chair.
Oh, perfect. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Michelle Guajardo. And I'm in support of this bill. Thank you for the opportunity today. I'm in support of this bill because I have incurred these expenses. I did tear down walls. It was over $5,000 for the walls to be torn down, or I could pay $15,000 to have sinks put into my 3 rooms. I started my business in 2015 where I rented a small office space. That was a very reasonable price. And I was able to keep my prices low for consumers. These new bills have made me raise prices, move my location, and cost of thousands and thousands of dollars, pretty much all of my savings, to meet these requirements so I could stay in business. So I am in support of this bill, and I thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you for your testimony. I have other testifiers, Ms. Fast, Mr. Hurst, and Ms. Garcia. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Gina Fast, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetology. The board is here to protect the health and safety of Minnesotans in the receipt of their hair, skin, and nail services. Eyelash extensions are a high-risk cosmetic service. They take a significant amount of precision and time to apply and are one of the more costly and time-consuming services the board regulates, with a very high maintenance schedule of clients going back roughly once every 2 weeks. Dangers include infection of the eye, eyelash, allergic reactions to the glue products, bacteria that grows, scratches to the cornea, alopecia of eyelashes, and the legislature, as stated earlier, has previously established that eyelash extensions should be regulated. My concern in exempting eyelash-only facilities is that the public deserves the same protections when receiving this service in a regulated salon that might offer more than one service versus just a facility that only offers eyelash extensions. We're well aware that eyelash extension salons want to expand their business by offering, let's say, eyebrow waxing or other types of services, so then they become in kind of a catch-22 of they don't, if this law passes as is, there would be no facility license. If facilities are not licensed, the board cannot inspect for continued infection control because we don't know where they exist, and we're unclear if this bill would actually give us the authority to inspect them. There are concerns of how liability or whether it's professional or workers' comp would be able to be obtained if the facility itself wasn't regulated. The board has not heard concerns of potential salons and us restricting them from opening. And frankly, we issue hundreds of salon licenses a year. I'm trying to skip around in brevity here. As the testifiers have indicated, the sink seemed to be in this work area seemed to be an issue. The board passed rules, went through a significant, about a three-year rulemaking process with several town halls and different public input that put these requirements on sinks and the work area. If the sinks are the problem for opening the business, the board would absolutely we can open up the rule. If the directive from the legislature was to look at this specific rule or look at where the obstacles are, we believe that this might be a bit overreactive for two individuals coming to testify. One of the testifiers was actually the individual who wanted the licensing, who was the initial creator of moving this forward. The board did not create the eyelash extension only license. So we do have concerns that maybe this is a little overreaching, and there could be some other ways to look at this. And of course, as you know, with rulemaking, the board had to go through a statement of need and reasonableness to defend every single rule that was changed, the sink being one of them. The second part of the bill that we are concerned with, which is the repeal of an eyelash salon manager. Repealing the salon manager license would actually limit career advancement and opportunity for eyelash technicians. Currently, when you finish school, you have two options of individual licenses. You either can become what we call an operator, or some people might just think of as a traditional practitioner, or you can become a manager. A manager's license allows you to be a designated manager responsible for the salon to the board. Many businesses require their licensees, whether you're a cosmetologist, nail technician, esthetician, or eyelash technician, to be a manager in order to, for instance, lease space. Suite-style salons where there's many independent single businesses, the owner of the building might require them to be a manager. If you didn't allow a manager's license to be offered, they might not be able to choose their own business path. So we have concerns that that's actually limiting the opportunity. And again, as we said, the eyelash extension legislation was recently settled after approximately 2 years of debate. Currently, the grandfathering period ended on February 1st of 2018, so just a few short months ago. There's currently 175 licensed eyelash technicians, 67 of them who are managers, and there's been approximately 20 salons that have been given an eyelash extension license, which ironically is the exact number we estimated in the fiscal note a couple years ago. To change the system of eyelash regulation and the licensing of salons without significant evidence of overburdensome problems, we think is a little premature. Also, there's no rulemaking authority to grant and reverse our existing rules. What would we do with the 67 existing eyelash technician salon managers? The bill does not address that. In speaking of treating them different, we were given no legislative directive that we should be parsing out salon licensing requirements based on the services offered. If that's something that's of interest to the legislature, the board would absolutely entertain that idea if we're to be starting to look at modified or varying salon requirements. So I think that we are absolutely open to a discussion. I think pulling the salon license has the biggest concerns to us. So I'm here to I'll stay because I know you're going through the testifiers to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bass. I've got Mr. Hurst and Ms. Garcia, and our time is running short, so if you can be mindful of that.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Salon and Spa Professional Association, a trade association that has been in existence since 1924 and represents the state's more than 30,000 licensed practitioners of cosmetology, which include hair, skin, nail, and also eyelash extension services. We are opposed to House File 3850, which seeks to repeal the salon license and salon manager license at eyelash extension locations. These salons use chemicals, such as glues and adhesives, along with specialty tools, such as tweezers and finely tipped awls, on the clients that they serve in a very sensitive and highly infection-prone area, namely your eyes. Tools must be infected or sterilized between every client. Adhesives must be tested first to ensure no allergic reactions may result. And failure to do so can result in great harm and actually potential blindness. I wish to share with you a letter that is currently going around, and I thank the page for doing that, from an ophthalmologist, Dr. Diane Tanabe. And unfortunately, it includes some rather graphic photos that demonstrate the very risks that can occur if proper care is not taken with infection control with these procedures. Some may say that there is little or no risk to the consumer, but this is unequivocally false, as you can see in the photos. And I again, encourage you to seriously look at that. Now, salon and salon manager licensing underscores the seriousness that must be taken in these service offerings. The state has a vested interest in protecting the health and safety of its citizens. And actually, if you look at Chapter 155A, it specifically states such as the state's policy. But only with licensing can the Board of Cosmetology, who just testified, can effectively achieve that. Only with licensing can the board have the jurisdiction that they need over these locations and conduct the compliance inspections that offer assurance to the public that they have some modicum of safety in these service providers. You know, if a citizen complaint is filed, the state board would have limited authority to actually go in and find the actual technician or the salon responsible. And without licensure, these salons would not be required to maintain any liability insurance, which is in the rules as a condition of licensure. you know, real briefly, I've taken a look at the licensure requirements in state rules. They have things such as, I don't think that are that burdensome, that require things such as you have to have a clean facility. You have to provide proof of liability insurance. You have to, I'm not going to take time here, but in just scanning over this. Now, the proponents of this have said that, have suggested that the state board has used a one-size-fits-all in regards to the rules and in regards to the salons. But I would counter-argue that their approach is a one-size-fits-all to counter that, and just getting rid of licensure is an extreme measure in addressing this. So, in closing, we do have serious thoughts, concerns with this legislation. Furthermore, if you remove licensure completely for these salons, then they're under no concern for compliance inspections coming along. They would have no need to necessarily abide by only employing licensed eyelash technicians, and by extension, and I'm sorry, no pun intended, they could then proceed to offer other services that they should be licensed for. But with that, I will close my comments, and I thank you for your time. I will certainly take questions, but in the interest of time, I do understand there's one more testifier, a licensed esthetician, and I wish to give her some time. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst. Ms. Garcia, and if you can limit your comments to 2 minutes, so otherwise we will be coming back after session. I do have Ways and Means, so it could be potentially after Ways and Means. So, Ms. Garcia.
Yes, thank you. My name is Judy Garcia. I am a licensed esthetician. I also have a licensed salon. And I understand if this bill passes, lash technicians will not be required to have a licensed salon, just like I have to have one. Starting a business is costly. It costs all of us to start a business. When I moved into my facility, there were absolutely no sinks. I installed 4 sinks in the facility that I am in currently in. Many of the requirements for opening a lash salon exist based on requirements by other state agencies, such as federal agencies such as OSHA or the ADA or EPA. Also, local agencies get involved. I had to go to my city and get releases from regarding fire code and local codes to see if I could even have a salon in that location. The requirements by the Board of Cosmetology are very minimal in comparison to all of the other state agencies that I had to meet requirements from. People, there's a couple of facts. For example, people always say this is a woman's issue. And it is a woman's issue. For crying out loud, we have over 30,000 licensees in this state, and about 90% of those are women that are already working in the profession and have had to comply with these laws and rules. They didn't come here and say, oh, change this for me, okay? Yes, many of the people that are doing lashes are women, with women of many ethnic backgrounds, just like licensees that are currently out there are of many ethnic backgrounds. It's been brought up, you have to remember that this is very dangerous. If you look at the implements, I think SSPA or Salon Spa Association gave you a picture of the implements that they work with around the eye. The fact that you're working in the eye area, you're working with mucous membrane areas, can be extremely dangerous. If I could give an example of flawed licensing, if myself as a licensed esthetician who has a licensed salon, let's say this is a strip mall. You all own businesses. One of you is a licensed esthetician, and you have a licensed salon, and that space over there is empty, and you want to lease it. And you put your business in there, and you're a licensed lash technician. Both of us are doing exactly the same service, okay? She can't get inspected. She has no oversight. But yet myself, as a licensee, is required to comply with salon licensing, all law rule, and receive fines, okay?
Final comments?
Final? I believe that to change this, if it passes, opens the door to complete deregulation of our profession piece by piece. And really, honestly, I'm a bit insulted by the fact that as a professional that is complying with the law is having to even come here and say something regarding this. Licensing is licensing. A woman is a woman. I am not any different than any woman that's a lash technician and should not be treated differently. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Representative Olson, I am at the hour that I need to end, but we do have the opportunity to finish this up. What would you prefer? Will we return or finish it now?
I would prefer to finish it up now.
Okay. Representative Flanagan, any closing comments?
Yes.
Oh, I need to first ask any questions, members. Anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just quick to wrap up, I want to just underline the fact again that Ms. Guajardo spent over $45,000 on remodels. I think that's outrageous and it's putting up some barriers. And just to the points that the Board of Cosmetology meant with regards to this limiting career options without the additional salon license, these women themselves have said this is the service that they're interested in providing. If they want to provide additional services, they can go back for that additional license, and that's an opportunity for them for self-determination. And the last thing that I would just lift up is through Mr. Hurst's testimony, as well as the letter that we've received from the Salon Spa Professional Association, the occupational license of 38 hours for technicians that they need to go through, the folks who are part of the Salon Spa Professional Association are actually exempt from that training. They can begin to provide the service without going through that training, and that should actually be concerning for all of us. They should be required to go through that training as well. And I think the Board of Cosmetology, as we're looking at who serves on the board, currently it is my understanding there's one individual of color to serve on that board and very few lash technicians. I think if we're going to do things in a good way, we need to ensure that the board also reflects the community it seeks to represent. That includes individuals of color and those who provide these services. And I ask for your support. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to renew, our Representative Flanagan is going to renew her motion that House File 3850 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. And with that, members,